Good afternoon, or in this case, good evening. Welcome to this joint hearing of the Education Reform and Education Finance Committee. I don't think we'll need to do introductions today, but just welcome those members of the committee who have been able to attend us with us today. We have one agenda item on this joint meeting tonight, and that is the Florida story. We have some individuals who are here to tell a story and help educate the members of this committee, so go ahead and please come forward. And if you'd like, if you could, please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now, we'll know who we were listening to. Members, what we'll do is we'll allow the presenters to go through and present their presentation, tell the story. And if it's okay with the testifiers, we'll periodically break for questions, if that's quite all right with people.
Sure.
To kind of break up the flow of things so you don't go through that entire bottle of water while you're sitting there talking. But again, thanks for making the trip to Minnesota. It's disappointing you weren't here last Monday. You could have experienced some authentic Minnesota weather, not the balmy 15 and 20 degree temperatures we're experiencing right now. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Patricia Levesque with the Foundation for Excellence in Education. Do you want everyone to introduce themselves or just?
Please.
I'm John Wynn, former Commissioner of Education, State of Florida.
I'm Jay Green, Professor of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas and a fellow at the George W. Bush Institute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to go through this PowerPoint very quickly. You have the full set in front of you, and so I'm going to skim over some of the slides. Just to give you some context on the Florida student population, we have 2.7 million students. We are a majority-minority state. With a large population of students who English is their second language, and about half of our students are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. So to put that in context, we have more students who are eligible for free and reduced price lunch than the student population in Minnesota. So the gains that you're going to see on some of the subsequent slides really show how much the policies that were put in place were able to move these most at-risk student populations. So the first slide is that of the National Assessment of Educational Progress for fourth grade reading, comparison of Florida and Minnesota. 10 points on this scale is the equivalent to about one grade level. So if you will look at 1998 is the year before our major accountability reforms were put in place, you can see that Florida students were more than a grade level behind Minnesota students. Fast forward to 2009, where Florida students are nearly a half a grade level ahead of Minnesota students on performance. For white students, you can see the same pattern. For black students, you can see in 1998, our students were nearly identical in performance, and now our African-American students are more than a year and a half ahead of African-American students in Minnesota. Hispanic students continued their progress in Florida. Economically disadvantaged students, again, great progress in the last several years. And I have to pause here to say, I'm not here to talk about look at how great Florida was or is. I want to highlight the fact that we were so bad before. We were near the bottom in all measures on student performance in our state. And because of some really laser-focused, student-focused policies, we have been able to dig ourselves out of a ditch. As my chairman says, if you're a giant among pygmies, you're still pretty short. And so we still consider ourselves very short. We have not done everything that we need to do, but we have moved from a very, very far distance. So the next slide shows you a comparison of Minnesota to Florida on the different performance levels identified on the NAEP. Below basic, if I could use a term, it means functionally illiterate. And so Minnesota has decreased their functionally illiterate population by 2% over that 17-year period. Florida was able to reduce that functionally illiterate population by 20% in the same period of time. Basic or better is just the converse of that slide I just showed you. But the next slide I want to articulate that The proficient level is that level above grade level, above basic performance on the NAEP. So Florida didn't just take our functionally illiterate students and just get them to grade level. We didn't just get them right over that bubble. We moved students even further on their proficiency level. So again, you can see Minnesota made progress, a 6% increase in the percent of their students that were proficient on the NAEP. Florida was able to make a 15% increase in that population over the same period of time. And then on the highest level on the NAEP, the advanced level, again, Minnesota made some good progress, a 3% increase, and Florida was able to almost triple the percent of students reading at the highest level on the NAEP. Again, before our accountability systems were put in place, fourth and eighth graders were below grade level in reading and math and scored near the bottom nationally, now are above the national average in almost every category. Our eighth graders are only 3 points behind beating the national average in math. To give you perspective on a state scale, our graduation rates in the eight-year period prior to our accountability systems being put in place declined by nearly 7%. We did a huge package of reforms in 1999, and many people said, when you put those reforms into place, you're going to have more students dropping out who can't meet the higher bar. We've actually had the opposite occur. Since the accountability systems were put into place, we've had a 21% increase in our graduation rate. So how did we do it? There were several foundational policies that I'm going to spend time talking about, and I'm going to go through all of these for you. First is our A through F school grading scale. Just to give you some context, our state test is called the FCAT, the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. It's aligned to our state standards in four subjects, reading, math, writing, and science. We test reading and math in every grade, 3 through 10, and we assess science and writing once at the elementary, middle, and high school level. The scale at the bottom just shows you what the student's performance scale is based on. So if a student scores level 3, it means their grade level, 4 and 5 above and 1 and 2 below. So in the mid-90s, right when the accountability movement nationally was kicking into high gear, Florida started grading our schools. We used what I would call fuzzy descriptors. So high-performing, low-performing, critically low-performing, how did you actually get on the critically low-performing list? When other states were also using descriptors like satisfactory and making progress and excelling or advancing. And if you talk to most parents in Florida or in other states, they couldn't tell you how their school was actually doing. Florida in 1998 moved to an even more brilliant model of labeling our schools level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And no one knew, did I want my school to be a level 1 school or a level 5 school? So in 1999, one of the main things we did was we started grading our schools A, B, C, D, F. And parents, the general public knew, even if they didn't know how a grade was calculated, they knew A and B was good, D and F was bad, and C, there was a lot of room for improvement. Just the simple labeling and making it transparent made a huge difference in our state. Let me give you an example. This is how our schools are graded. So there are basically eight categories that go into a school grades calculation. 50% or half of the grade is based on proficiency. In other words, are the students on grade level or higher based on their test scores? And you can see we measure proficiency on the reading, math, writing, and science scores. 50% or half of the school's grade is based on individual progress, because it doesn't matter if a student is above grade level or below grade level, and a teacher can't control the performance level of students that she receives, but she can control whether or not those students make progress from wherever they started the year. So individual student progress for us is a measure of how did Johnny in fifth grade do to Johnny's performance in fourth grade. It is not a comparison of Johnny versus Susan's performance. And so you can see in the 50% of the measures that are based on individual progress, half of that is based on the progress of all students in the school. Every child matters. Every child should move forward. But if you also see, half of that progress measure is also based on the progress of the lowest performing 25% in the school. We did not, because our policy was in place before federal law, we did not look at ethnic subgroups. How did the African American or Hispanic or students with disabilities do? Instead, we focused on the lowest performing 25% because every school has a lowest performing 25%. Whether that's comprised of white students, black students, students with disabilities, every school has to make effort to make progress with its lowest performers. And that's one of the ways we're seeing that we're narrowing the achievement gap, is because lowest performing students are basically double weighted in our school grading scale. So this is a sample school in Florida. If 63% of the students are reading on grade level, the school gets 63 points. If 66% of the students made progress in reading, doesn't matter if they were on grade level or not, did the school move them forward, the school gets 66 points. And basically, you add up the points, and that gives you the school's grade. Now, because the calculation is so simple and is so transparent, it really gives our principals direction on how to deploy resources into the school. So this principal, for example, could look and see, we're doing a great job in writing, and can continue doing whatever policies they have in place on writing. But the principal could look at their most struggling area is science. So then that principal makes decisions for the next school year on staffing, on professional development, on resources, on curriculum. And the principal knows exactly what to focus on in order to improve the school's grade the following year. This chart just shows you the number of points for each grade scale, A, B, C, D, F. We do have a criteria on districts or schools have to test the certain percentage of students who are eligible for testing. And then we have one other issue called adequate progress to make sure, again, that they focus on the lowest performing students in the school. If a school earned 550 points, so it was eligible for an A, if they still did not make enough progress with the lowest performing students in the school, their grade would drop to a B. Of the 3,500 schools in the state, that issue impacted maybe 30 schools, mainly your upper middle income schools that needed to do a better job focusing on their lower performing student population. Yes, sir.
Just a quick question, because my private sector job, I'm employed as a network engineer, and I like metrics. And one of the things I've noticed is that people tend to support metrics when they make them look good, and they tend to oppose the metrics when it makes them look bad. Can you talk about sort of the, when this was unveiled, how did the school communities respond to this? Has there been evolving of people's perceptions and assessments towards these metrics? Can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. If you let me get to two slides, can I get to two slides and then it'll make it even more clear?
I don't know. How long are you going to take on the next two slides?
The next one will be really fast.
All right. We'll wait. Thanks.
So everything that I just showed you is how we have graded elementary, middle, and high schools for several years. Last year, we added some other factors to the high school grade calculation. So in addition to test scores, our high schools are graded based on graduation rates of their at-risk students. So basically, eighth graders that entered ninth grade and were below grade level, what percent of those students graduated 4 years later? We take a look at acceleration rates. So the percent of students taking and passing advanced placement, international baccalaureate, industry certification exams. And we also look at college readiness rates. So here's the results. The first year we started grading our schools, we had more D and F schools than A and B schools. So to answer your question, Mr. Chairman, they hated it. They hated it before the results were even calculated. We had, I think, every major education group in the state, from the Teachers Union to the Superintendents Association, School Board Association, PTA, School Administrators Association. There was an outright rejection of all of the policies that were put in place in 1999. A lot of the angst was focused on a voucher that was part of the overall accountability system, but I will tell you there were numerous amendments to change and do what I would call fuzzy up the descriptors again so that it wasn't A, B, C, D, F, but it was just a different nomenclature. But A through F grading, the labeling of A through F really was opposed by most education groups. I will tell you now, fast forward to 2011, it's not even discussed. There were bills that were filed for maybe 8 years in a row to get rid of the A through F label and to go back to something else. Bills don't get filed now because the general public, it's what they rely on. I think if you took away A through F grading in Florida now, you'd have a lot of parents say, well, how am I going to know how my school's doing if you remove A, B, C, D, F? So if you look at it, in 1999, we had more D and F schools than A and B schools. Fast forward to 2010, we have 10 times as many A and B schools as D and F schools. And those dotted arrows are points in time where we actually made it harder to be an A, B, C, D, or F. One of the philosophies of our commissioner and of our governor at the time were that you need to set the bar high but attainable. Don't set the bar so high that no one will be able to achieve it and that everyone will be a failure, but then continuously raise that bar as your schools and your students rise to meet the challenge. And that's what we've been doing over the last several years. Just to give you some practical implications or impacts of the A through F grading scale, one was just a command focus on learning. And I'll give you an example of a school board. All of our school boards have to publish their school board agenda in the paper so you can see what's on their agenda. In Leon County, which is Tallahassee, Florida, so it's a very well-educated community, state government, several universities, the Leon County School Board put on one of their agendas that they were the first county to not have any D or F schools. They committed a whole school board meeting to discuss what was their strategy for making sure they were the first county with no C schools. I will tell you, if the labels were that C schools were called satisfactory or making adequate progress, you would not have seen that focus from the community on eliminating satisfactory schools. But C was not acceptable. And so that's one of the practical impacts of A through F grading. On media and public attention, now in the back-to-school newspaper editions of our papers, it's not just a focus on when are the school start times, where are the school bus routes, and what are the school lunch menus for the first week of school. The grade of the school is published in the newspaper, and if it's anything less than an A or a B, the newspaper will oftentimes highlight what's the deficiency in the school. A statewide competition to be the best of the best. We grade our school districts as if they were a single school. And what that has done is caused districts to be competitive with one another. So I'll give you, Miami Herald covers Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties, three of our very large counties. And so when the newspaper publishes on how the districts are doing, that shines a light on if one of those counties is lower in performance than a neighboring county. Community support. I grew up in Central Florida in an area called Pine Hills, one of the most poor, high-crime communities. The high school that I was zoned for 20-something years ago was a failing school 20-something years ago. Nobody wanted to send their child there, but no one ever did anything about it either. As soon as Evans High School was labeled an F for the first, second, third, fourth year, the school board members on the north side of town started paying attention to what was going on in the south side school because they didn't want an F school in their district. And so Evans got more resources. The school district tried to put more effective teachers. They've even had month-long debates on giving the school a new facility. The focus on how to turn around those F schools was incredible, and I'm going to go on just a little bit longer here. We had a lot of nonprofits in the state that were involved in mentoring or that were involved in programs of getting community support into schools. Once we had the A through F grades on schools, a lot of what happened was more focused, targeted resources to the schools that needed it. So when CEOs would mentor in schools, they would be deployed into the schools that have the D or F rating because that's where the CEOs need to mentor the principal most. A lot of those things occurred directly because of the A through F grading scale. So now that we graded schools, A through F, what else was tied to the school grade? One was a rewards program that was put into place. So any school that moved from an F to a D, D to a C, C to a B, B to an A, got reward money. That reward money went straight to the school principal and the teachers and the parents, and they decided how to spend the funds. It bypassed collective bargaining and the superintendents and the school boards. And the majority of the funds that were used locally went for school-wide bonuses. So those school-wide bonuses are what made everyone involved. The teachers, the janitors, the cafeteria workers, everyone started paying attention to what was going on to the academics in the school. The program varies in size each year because, again, it's dependent upon how many schools increase a letter grade or maintain their A grade. But I want to focus on this, especially in tight budget years. We did not use new money to fund this program. We took an existing pot of money that was previously just formula funded to the counties, and we said first use of this pot of money is going to fully fund the rewards to the schools that improved a letter grade. Then anything that was left over gets formula funded to the counties. And so in a $20+ billion public school budget, this reward program at its peak is $150 million. So repurposing $150 million of existing dollars has really driven a lot of student performance. And plus, it's a benefit for the grading system so that there's some fun stuff, some good stuff that comes out of the letter grading scale. The consequences for results that were put into place. If a school was an F twice in a four-year period, all the students in the school were eligible for choice. Any public school in their district, in a neighboring district, or to a private school. There's some research that Dr. Green is going to talk about a little bit more. I will tell you, in the height of the program, only 753 students participated in the private school choice portion of that voucher. The program was in place for 7 years before our state Supreme Court, based on language in our state constitution, stopped the private school choice option. So the public school choice options are still going on today.
Very briefly, could you explain, previous to the opportunity scholarships, what sort of public school choice existed in Florida?
Florida does not have as robust a public school choice program as Minnesota. Before that, every district was required by law to have what was called a controlled open enrollment plan, basically public school choice within the district. That didn't dictate full choice, so in some of our larger districts, they could have done zones, you know, a north zone, a south zone, an east zone, and students could have choice within the zones. They were all required to have plans. They weren't required to implement the plans. Most of them did, but public school choice was pretty limited in the state. Okay, Mr. Chairman. So the research on the Opportunity Scholarship Program, again, many different research entities compared and did similar research studies, basically looking at degraded schools. Degraded schools, some that had one F in their history, some that had no Fs in their history. So by all accounts, the only difference in the two schools is if the school that had one F in their background got another F, vouchers would kick in. And what the researchers found were that the schools that had that threat of a voucher performed consistently, statistically significantly better than the degraded schools that had no threat of a voucher. Then you can see in 2006, when our Supreme Court eliminated the private school option, there was no statistical difference between those degraded schools on performance. So we graded our schools, A through F, in a very public, transparent way. We provided rewards and consequences. We also did some things that I would call quality controls in a couple of areas. One of those quality control areas was in third grade. So as we all know, students from kindergarten through third grade are still learning how to read. When they get to fourth grade, they're expected to read in order to learn their material. So if we were promoting students to fourth grade who didn't have fundamental reading skills, we knew we were dooming them to a life of high likelihood of not graduating from high school. So our policy that was put in place was basically students who scored at level one, the very lowest level on our state test, basically functionally illiterate students, had to be retained unless they met a good cause exemption. Several of those exemptions were related to students with disabilities or English language learners, students who had previously been retained. But we also had alternative tests that were eligible because we knew for third graders, one test on one day, kids could have a bad test day. We also had a student portfolio policy that where a teacher could show through a demonstration of the student's work that the student really was eligible to move on to fourth grade. Now, this chart shows you, it's a comparison of the percent of students reading at that lowest performing level on our state test compared to how many students were retained. So you can see in year one, and I call it year one, the year that the Orlando Sentinel started writing articles about this, saying, we have all these kids who can't read, and what are we doing about them? We had 29% of our students that scored level one on the state test, and we retained less than 3%. So we knew we were promoting 26% of our kids who couldn't read to the next grade. Look at 2002-2003, the year that the retention policy was put in place. We retained 13% of our third graders that year. Now, the difference between the 23% who were functionally illiterate and the 13% are those good cause exemptions that were on the previous slide. The good news on this chart is that every year we're seeing declines in the number of level one or functionally illiterate third graders, and we're also seeing subsequent declines in the percent of kids who are having to be retained. Now, I'll tell you that we passed the law in 2000, but phased it in, and so that districts were given notice that 2 years from now the policy will be in place. What the district started doing because of this policy was intervening earlier. They started intervening with kindergartners and first and second graders because they didn't want children to get to third grade who didn't have fundamental reading skills. Research has been very clear. The policy has worked, but you're going to hear more from Dr. Green about that later. Graduation rates, graduation requirements, we had for 30 years an exit exam that was required to get a diploma.
I'm going to ask a quick question. My apologies for interrupting you. Just going back to your previous slide there, you know, some people might say that, you know, because the NAEP is the NAEP's at fourth grade, right? Yeah. NAEP's at fourth and eighth grade, that what you're doing is, well, you're holding back the troubled third graders. And by holding back the troubled third graders, of course your fourth grade scores are going to go up.
Sure.
So how would you respond to that?
I think you'll see at the end of my presentation, you're going to see data on our state test and the trend lines so that if the policy wasn't continuing, you would see drops then in the years after those retained students got into fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and you don't see that happening. But again, Dr. Green can show you some more, and I know based on the senator's question that I'm going to need to get another chart to email you all that shows that trend line across through 10th grade now.
Do you have a question I can ask you that is not addressed in the presentation in the future?
Just so she's very
I've given this presentation many times.
Please proceed.
Chairman. So graduation requirements, again, we had an 8th grade level test. 10% of our students couldn't pass the 8th grade level test after five chances and couldn't get their diploma. We raised the bar. We made it a 10th grade level test, and we have more students passing the more rigorous exam now than we're passing the 8th grade exam. Just data on our high school graduation rate trend lines for all students and all demographic subgroups going in the right direction. And actually, you can see the graduation rate gap narrowing among white and black and white and Hispanic students. One of the other policies we put in place was some changes in how we funded our school districts. We had several pots of money in our calculation for our funding formula that funded failure. In other words, we had a summer school pot of money that the only way a district could access is if they had students in summer school. Dropout prevention money that the only way they could access it if they put students in dropout prevention programs. And so we said, let's take a look a different way to fund our districts. And we took all those pots of money, put them into one big pot, an uber categorical, and said, school districts, you're going to get this money no matter what. And what we need you to do first is help your struggling schools and then help your struggling students in third grade and high school graduation. And after that, you can do whatever you want to with the money. And so what it incentivized was districts to act more efficiently in their interventions. Instead of waiting with a struggling student to sit them in summer school to give them remediation during summer school, districts started implementing after-school tutoring or Saturday classes or bringing in a specialist in the middle of the school year to help with the most struggling students, because they really wanted to be able to do whatever they wanted to with the money, so they were more efficient with how they used the funds during the school year. And again, in a $20-plus billion budget, redirecting $700 million of it, a very small portion of it, that was primarily existing funds, and giving it to the districts in a different way incentivized a different type of behavior. Incentivizing rigor. One thing that we knew we wanted to do was get more kids ready for college, and a way to do that was incentivizing advanced placement courses and also students to take the SAT or ACT. And if you back up to that, one of the best indicators for a student being on a college track is whether or not they're taking the pre-SAT or the plan test, the precursor to the ACT. We dove into the data and found that students at our A schools, about 85% of them took the PSAT. But in our F schools, less than 15% took that test, primarily because it was a cost and our low-income students couldn't afford the test. So we put in place a policy to provide free PSAT tests or plan tests to all 10th graders in the state. For a state our size, less than $2 million. A state the size of Minnesota, it would be less than $700,000 for you to provide this to all students in your state. What we then did...
And we have a question here from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Levesque, do most Florida schools require the SAT test? Is that why you gave the PSAT, or they also take the ACT?
Our districts get to select, so we don't tell them which test to take. About half of the districts. We have 67 school districts. About half of them select for their students to take the plan, the test, the precursor to the ACT. About half in number choose the PSAT. And however, if you look at the numbers, the districts that choose the SAT or the PSAT in Florida really is a far greater student population. So we're an SAT-dominant state based on district selection. But we don't limit them at the state level to the PSAT or the plan. They get to pick. I'm highlighting the PSAT here mainly because we developed a unique relationship with the College Board. They have a tool called the AP Potential, where it's actually aligned the PSAT score with a tool that identifies the students that are most likely to succeed in advanced placement. And we use that in the majority of our school districts to help the guidance counselors know how to counsel the kids toward taking the more rigorous college-level coursework. We started providing professional development for teachers to teach AP, something that I know you all do here. We implemented a bonus program in the early 90s as a way to actually fund our AP programs. So whenever a student passes an AP exam, the school gets a bonus, and that's what they really use to fund their AP program. What we did in 2000 was say, out of that school bonus, the teacher gets $50. So the teacher who taught the student who successfully passed gets $50, and an even more incentive to make sure our underrepresented students were benefited. The teacher gets $500 if one student at a DRF school passes an AP exam for college credit. Here are some of the results. So you can see the trend line going up in the number of kids taking AP exams. The year we started providing free PSAT tests, linking that to encouraging them into AP courses, providing the professional development, and also providing the teacher bonus, look at the trajectory on our students taking AP exams. I want you to notice the jump between 2009 and 2010. Remember when I said just last year we changed how we graded our high schools and we started adding other criteria? We started adding in the percent of kids taking and passing AP exams. So just because it got measured the increase you can see overnight just by applying that policy to how we grade our schools.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Chair. We had a program here in Minnesota for a while, and at least in my district, created some difficulties because those of us who were taking advanced placement were getting these bonuses. And some of our colleagues who were not teaching advanced placement, their students were doing well. They were progressing as well. So they got nothing. So it caused some consternation and bad feelings. And then the state decided after a while to eliminate the program for budgetary reasons. So I'm just wondering, do you run into any of those kinds of controversies within faculties?
Sure.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, the year that we proposed the policy, there was opposition by the state education groups, by the teachers union, who didn't want there to be any test-based distinctions between teacher pay, by the school districts who said, we can't afford to run our AP programs if you carve $50 out of our, at that point in time, $1,000 bonus that the school got. I think we just made it, we just resolved that it was a good thing to incentivize our teachers to help the children be successful in taking and passing the AP courses for credit, and we just continued the policy. I will tell you now, there's no animosity. We don't get the complaints. You don't have the teachers writing in saying this is so unfair. But I'll tell you, the trend nationally is to tie more student performance to teacher evaluations and then have performance pay in the fundamental scale. So this type of program is nothing compared to what Florida is proposing now for teacher pay, teacher evaluations. So
Representative Benson, did you have a follow-up?
You all, concern of teachers then who have what we might call the mainstream courses, and they do not at present get any incentive, even though their students may be showing significant continuing progress, whereas those teachers who are assigned to advanced placement, they do get the bonus and it does not create any difficulty. Are you sure?
The test fire.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, remember, we do have a school-wide recognition program so that when all the students are improving, so the school increases a letter grade, all the teachers can benefit out of that program. We did implement some other merit pay programs in the late, like in 2008, 2009, that were only in effect for a year. I'll tell you what Florida is undertaking right now is just a complete change to the salary structure so that all teachers are put on a performance-based salary schedule depending on how their students do on whatever class they're teaching. So most of that will be dealt with over the next 3 or 4 years in the state.
Representative Benson.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich. Representative Dietrich, could you do me a favor? Let me turn one of the microphones to you. We are taping this, and I'm afraid that
okay,
we might
thank you.
Let me get this.
This is to Representative Benson's point, and I didn't plan on asking this question, but I'm going to ask it because he mentioned this. When I went to the state of Arkansas and they had exponentially increased the amount of students taking AP classes, it seemed to me at least that the teachers ended up putting a lot of extra time into the students in helping them be successful in passing the AP tests. I mean, I remember they had Saturday study sessions. They had early morning study sessions just to help the kids be successful. Is that what you find in the state of Florida also that helps justify some of that extra money?
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do find that. And actually, our former commissioner, John Wynn, is the president of the National Math and Science Initiative, an initiative to actually help states who want to incentivize AP test-taking across the country, and he could speak to just globally states that are providing these incentives and what the results have been.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then the question I had originally is, what tool did you say that you use to help identify children who might be in an AP IB type track?
Sure. Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, it's called the AP Potential. It's something unique to the College Board, and it's tied specifically into the PSAT, which is why I probably refer to the PSAT more than I do the plan test, is because that's a tool that we have at our disposal since we're a PSAT-heavy state in order to guide guidance counselors into encouraging kids into AP.
Dietrich, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if we use that at all, or is this a different tool, and we just call it something different? Or I've just never heard of it before, and I'm very fascinated by that tool, if it exists.
Yeah. Ms. Levesque.
The PSAT is the practice SAT. Basically, it's been around forever. What the College Board provides is an analysis based on their years of study of students who perform at a certain level on the PSAT and how well those students perform when they take advanced placement and then the SAT. So what they do is for every school, you have to ask for it, but for every school they will provide a detailed list by student name of students that they believe, if you have enough students taking the PSAT, that they believe would be successful in advanced placement. And what that did for Florida, what it continues to do in Arkansas and other states that our organization support the program, is it changes the whole view of who is eligible for AP. And what we found in Florida was that basically, you know, and it exists today. When you talk with people, and advanced placement is the top 1 or 2%, the brainiacs, the kids that are already going to college and so on and so forth. And if that's the only kid that you think ought to go into AP and the only kids that you offer it, then that's the truth. That's what it is for. But when you start, and we used statewide in the PSAT, we brought our guidance counselors together and said, look at the kids that you now have in advanced placement in your school, and look at, it's not the Department of Education, look at what the College Board says can do. It is far more diverse, much larger, and Representative, to your point, what we did is we paid for free summer training for any teacher that wanted to become an AP teacher. So if you're complaining about, you know, you want to have, you know, you can become an AP teacher by going through, and if you're encouraging more kids to take AP courses, you fill more seats. So it all sort of grows, it grows together.
Representative Dietrich, did you have a follow-up?
So this tool, is part of the PSAT, or
is it
a separate?
It is the PSAT test.
Okay, so is there anybody in the room here that knows? Do we use the PSAT to that level, and what is the difference here? I would presume that it is that we just let kids who want to take the PSAT take it, and those.
It appears appears resident expert Representative Tilbury is going to offer a thought into the microphone. Into the microphone, I hope. Representative Tilbury.
What we do here in the state of Minnesota is mostly focus on ACT scores or ACT part. So it's mostly you can sign up for the PSAT and take it, but we pretty much have been funding more of the ACT approach. So my follow-up question was, what do we have in the ACT that would be similar to what is offered?
Representative Tilbury wisely jumps to the front of the line and ahead of the questioners. So, yeah, that might be the first question that I'll have staff put down. Unless if our testifiers know, that might be one of the first questions we have for the Department of Education, and maybe we can share that with the committee. Does any of the testifiers know?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe they do, or else we would use it in the state. That's why we really do encourage the PSAT in our state, so that there is that linkage to AP, because we want to incentivize more AP. In fact, you can see in our numbers, the more students that are taking and passing AP, the impact that we have in our college remediation statistics. So the college remediation numbers were declining when we raised the bar on high school graduation, and also when this class of kids, that were more of them, are being encouraged to take AP based upon their PSAT score. You can see the impact and savings on our community college side of the equation.
Thank you. Representative Mariani and then Representative Dabney. Representative Mariani.
You forgot me.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For some of us, it's easier to talk into the mic because, you know, we can face the room and have the mic before us. So, obviously, in the House, we do things a little bit better than the Senate does.
As usual,
Mr. Chair. Well, welcome to Minnesota. My brother and my mom live in the Orlando area, and they usually call me a lot this time of year to remind me about how it's 80, 85 degrees out, and it's awfully warm, and what's the weather like up there in Minnesota? And so anyway, but welcome. This is, I guess, relatively minor question because it doesn't, I believe, go to the major model logic. However, I couldn't resist asking this question. Back on page 19, we look at the high school graduation rates for Florida, and I believe, Ms. Levesque, you said that the gaps were narrowing. I guess I'm going to have to differ with you, unless you call it 18% gap between African Americans in 1999. And a 17% gap with African Americans and whites 10 years later. I guess technically it's narrowing, but unfortunately I don't think that that's what's happening here. And it does seem, and quite frankly, that's true in virtually every other state I've seen, this data. There is sort of this phenomenon that even as we're driving greater outcomes, to the degree that there are increases, we aren't closing gaps. We're just simply mirroring the steps. And so it begs the question for certain communities, if you're going to close the gap, then those communities simply have to grow much faster than the community that you're comparing them to. And so I guess maybe my question would be a little bit of ability to redeem yourself here. Relative to your model, what can you tell us about the use of this model that will, in fact, accelerate the achievement outcomes of students of color relative to the white students? Because, quite frankly, at this level of gap closing, we're probably going to have to wait 100 years before we're at parity.
Sure. To any of the testifiers.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what you'll see later in the presentation and because I do have slides on that, although what I owe you now, knowing this, and I'll write it down, I will send you the data on our state tests and on the NAEP to show longitudinal data to show the gap is narrowing on student performance. And it's not something that I came up with. It's the U.S. Department of Education that identified Florida as one of only three states in the whole country that is narrowing the achievement gap between white and black, rich and poor, white and Hispanic. And in fact, the gap between white and Hispanic on, not in the graduation rates that you identified on that chart, but on the NAEP test are virtually eliminated. Our Hispanic students are almost performing at the average across the country, or they actually are performing and beating the average student across the country. So if you'll indulge me for some slides later in the presentation, and then I'll write it down, I will send you broken down by race, white, black, and Hispanic, actual performance trend lines. And we could give it to you for students with disabilities and English language learners, and you can see how the gap is narrowing on our state tests.
If you could please make sure to share that information with either Chairman Erickson's staff or my staff. We'll make sure that members of both the Reform and Finance Committees get that information. Representative Mariani, did you have a follow-up? Representative Dabney, and then Erickson, because apparently I forgot to call on her. So, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to the issue of AP participation, South High School in my district is the only high school in the state that requires all juniors to take an AP class. And the previous commissioner led a tour of the school this past fall. To look at the work that South was doing. And so the chair may want to think about bringing South in to talk about what it means because, as I think some of the testifiers referenced, for some kids it's clear and obvious. For some kids it's heavy lifting by both the student and the staff. And some of that is convincing the student that they're capable. Right. You know, they may be capable, but they may not believe that. And so a lot of that to get them over the hump is confidence building as well as the academic prep. I think I'm interested in two things, one related to the AP, one a couple of slides back, but Daniel Pink, this is not the first time I've referenced him in this committee this year. His most recent book is Drive, and it looks at motivation. And his conclusion is that when you get past paying the extra for how quickly I dig the ditch, and you know, get outside of physical labor and want me to apply creativity and connection and build relationships and use those sorts of different skills that are more intrinsic, that actually providing financial incentives is long-term disincentivizing. Okay, I got the guy with the PhD said I was right. So I'm going with the guy at the end. And I'm wondering, you know, as we look not towards performance pay but bonuses for this and that, you actually change the motivation from, Jay, I think you should take an AP class because I think you've got the potential to, Jay, it's worth $50 to me. And that's a very different incentive and can actually backfire on everybody. And I'm wondering if any of the testifiers could comment on what the research shows on the disincentivizing nature of bonuses versus your work in Florida.
So the first question is, Dr. Green, did Representative Dabney just make up a word?
It sounds like the sort of thing academics would say, so it sounds like a word.
Okay, and then not to Representative
not to be confused with an academic, but
to the three testifiers to this question.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that, there is, like anything, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And the way we tried to do it is to build a comprehensive program that is important a cornerstone as the bonuses or awards or whatever you want to call it to teachers. That was in our experience in the six states that the National Math and Science Initiative is basically implementing this type of program, what we see is a huge unfreezing of the school culture in terms of expectations of students. Okay, and what the bonuses do, and we provide awards for students who pass AP in the program that we develop public-private partnerships for. Now, anybody who's known a kid or helped a kid go through an advanced placement course knows that if they knew it at the end how much work it was going to be for a few dollars, mm-hmm. they would have never made the deal. Sure. It's not the money. It's the symbolic effect that somebody thinks it's important enough to put money on. Okay? And that has to be combined with mining your current students to find students who are being, strictly speaking, overlooked, and saying, encouraging them and believing that they can do it, and providing a system to better train teachers to reach down and help kids who are taking a risk and needs extra help to do it. Providing additional training for that, opening up so more teachers will go into it. And it's all wrapped around a belief that students can achieve at extraordinarily high levels that they themselves never thought they could. Now, incentives, when you put incentives up against that type of an approach, they're a relatively modest part of the program. But it doesn't mean that they at all work negatively against the program. These teachers are proud of what they've accomplished, and they're proud that they're being rewarded for it at the end.
Representative Dabney, a follow-up?
Not so much a follow-up as a segue, and I appreciate the chair's tolerance. In the presentation, this maybe from Ms. Levesque.
Levesque.
Thank you. There's been, I think, an implication that we did X and Y happened. And I'm assuming that you didn't just do X and then wait to see if Y happened. That if you're like most states, you've got about 14 different things that you're doing at once, and any omnibus education bill is, you know, makes an octopus look look easy. What would you say, particularly, say, if we look at some of the reading stuff that you led with initially, what was the most important thing that Florida did, thing or things that Florida did that impacted reading scores in the state, since that's so critical?
Sure.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll stop now.
Mr. Chairman, the A through F grading scale was by far one of those things that, for a comprehensive school change, A through F grading scale made all the adults in the system make sure that students were learning, because that grade has such an impact to the public, to the parents, to the media. A through F grading had a huge impact. And it didn't hurt that rewards were, you know, they got some financial incentive to do it and that there were consequences. The third grade reading policy is one of those things that you'll see in some upcoming slides. You can see the clear trend line of where that policy, you can see it in the data, how it's made a difference in student performance. The College Board partnership that I'm talking about here wasn't an overall impact on reading scores, but this program is one of the few things that we did that had bipartisan support. Our Black caucus, our Hispanic legislative caucus, it remains one of those programs that is high, and our rural lawmakers remain something that's high on their agenda, because the main direction of those funds were where we were underrepresented with our minority students and our rural students. So giving them an opportunity to take the free PSAT and then doing what our former commissioner very kindly put it as, the kids who are overlooked because of what they look like on the outside versus what was in their head. And so making sure that there was an objective measure to make sure the adults in the system were encouraging every child that should be taking AP to take AP. I think this program made a huge difference on our AP scores and our preparation for college.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Levesque, did you offer advanced placement 9 through 12?
We school districts can offer it. We actually passed a law 2 years ago because not every high school was offering advanced placement, even with these incentives built in. Some of our high schools were not. So the law actually kicks in next school year. So next school year, every high school in the state of Florida has to offer one core AP course in the four core areas: math, English, language arts, science, and social studies. They have to offer at least one in each of the core areas. And so we'll see after that's been in place for a while if there's a trend towards more students taking it, because now they actually have access to it.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Levesque, students who are ninth graders or freshmen, or students who are sophomores, could enroll if a high school offered an AP course. Is that correct?
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, some of the districts set different bars for entry into AP, but I think for the most part, ours entered in 10th grade after their PSAT score, primarily 11th and 12th grade taking the AP courses.
And Ms. Levesque, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said some of your schools also use the plan as the test to know whether or not they should take AP courses. Is that correct? And to what extent is that test successful, because we have used that in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to get you an analysis. The main districts that use the plan are smaller rural districts. So since we don't have that tool to identify which students, based on the plan score, should be taking AP courses, it's the other parts of our policy that I think really overcomes that issue for us in the rural counties, the fact that districts can earn bonus money to run their AP programs, the professional development that is provided based on the state, and I think, again, you all provide the professional development, is targeted more toward the struggling schools, so C, D, and F schools, and the teachers in those schools to learn how to teach and offer AP. I think the great equalizer is going to be when our new policy kicks in next year, where every high school has to offer a core AP course, that you're going to see even greater jumps in the data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question, Ms. Levesque. Does Florida have other choices for their students in the realm of college prep? For example, do they have college courses available to them on campus, or a post-secondary enrollment option such as we have, or concurrent enrollment? Do you offer those opportunities too?
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chair, we do have, we call it dual enrollment. So students, public, private, and home education students can take dual enrollment in any of our state colleges, state community colleges, and even our state universities after meeting certain thresholds to get into the course. And this, the state funds it through the public school funding formula. Even if the student's taking the course on the community college campus, the school district can generate funds for a student taking that dual enrollment course.
Thank you.
Ms. Levesque, we're going to take one more question, and then that'll be Representative Norton, and then the other three questioners will put you on the top of the list for when we want to make sure we get as much testimony in as possible. So our final question goes to Representative Norton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I was curious into your testimony in this on this particular slide. You talked about the PSAT being free and that you have allocated funds for that, and as a freshman legislator, my superintendent had me carry a bill about ACT and SAT scores and making or tests, and making sure all students had an opportunity to take them, only to find out that ACT and SAT offer two or one, depending on your thing, free tests for all students anyway. Mm-hmm. So I wondered, is the PSAT not something that they offer scholarships for? Because it sounded like in your discussion, you as a state are funding that. Could you address that a little bit?
Sure. Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, the College Board does offer waivers. So mm-hmm. if you're a low-income student and you request a waiver, you can get a waiver to take some of the tests. I think that having the state, I think Commissioner Wynn said this, set as a state-level policy that this is important to us and we're going to invest the funds into providing the free tests to our students. And again, the College Board still can provide the waivers for the low-income students. That caused all of our school districts to take a second look on encouraging the students to take the tests. And then, because as our accountability system continued, and you can see up until this last year, our schools are now being graded on how many kids take and pass AP or IB or industry certification exams. Now our school districts want that assistance in encouraging the students to take AP through the free PSAT test because now they're going to be graded on it. So it's something that our school districts, even when our budgets are looking bleak, and that's one of the issues that maybe some member wants to cut, our school districts now come out and say, please don't cut that program because we need it.
Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, I would just say we probably should make some contacts with, given my experience, I had calls from everybody around the country on this, that they do offer the waivers, and they, in fact, told me they would offer unlimited so that any student in the state of Minnesota could have them and that there was no limit as to how many they would give out. We might want to make some contacts on that. And also, I just want to mention, as we're talking plan and PSAT, in Minnesota, most of our students take the ACT exam because most of the colleges that our students go to in this area accept the ACT. And so I know my school district has made it an effort for a number of years to increase the number of students taking AP and particularly focusing on students with diverse backgrounds. And in fact, have had great fortune without having any financial incentives, but that we maybe look a little bit further into what could happen with the plan exam and how we might use that, because I would hate to disincent students to take the exam that the colleges they want to go to are going to require, which, again, is the ACT for most of our kids. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Norton. To the testifiers, go ahead now. We'll take a break in the questions for a while here, and okay. Please proceed with your testimony.
I'm just going to fly through the next slides, just really show how on the College Board partnership that we have, the impact on Hispanic and African-American students. 505% increase in Hispanic test takers, 719% in African American. And then the later charts show you the increase in the passing scores based on the program. Opportunities for success, I think it's something that you all have already maybe passed legislation this session on. Prior to 2002, the only way you could teach in a Florida public school was to have a degree from a college of education or go back and get pedagogy course credits from a college of education. We realized that we needed to open up paths for alternative routes to certification into our state. So in 2002, we opened up those doors, and we actually accept any other state's teaching certificate, so we have full reciprocity with other states. We accept the National Board and the American Board certificate. We allow our state community colleges to compete with universities in offering the pedagogy for people to reenter the classroom. Every school district in the state is required to have an online, on-the-job alternative certification program. We recognize years of teaching in higher education to comply with some of the requirements for our K through 12 teaching certificates, and we require our universities to offer education as a minor so the person can get a math major and an education minor and be able to enter the classroom. So we passed the law in 2000. It went into effect in 2002. And by 2004, we were recruiting and hiring more teachers through alternative routes of certification than through traditional College of Ed degrees in the state. Choices. We had lots of educational choice in the state. A McKay scholarship, which is basically a voucher for students with disabilities. We have 500,000 students with disabilities in the state and 21,000 taking the voucher. That's less than 5%. So when you offer full choice, the vast majority of your kids will stay right where they are because they're pleased with that option. Dr. Green's going to talk about the research on the effectiveness of the McKay Scholarship Program. We have a tax credit scholarship that corporations can get a dollar-for-dollar tax break for funds they give to nonprofits to help low-income students go to private school. And again, I could go over the research, academic, and financial benefits of the program. You all lead the country in charter schools, so I'm not going to spend much time on charter schools. Virtual education. We do have a state online public virtual school that is the largest in the country. Homeschool, private school, public school students can take courses for free. I will tell you we're working on a digital learning bill in the state right now that will change the use of digital learning in the state where any student, I'll talk about our future bills at a future time. Voluntary pre-K. We had a constitutional amendment in 2005 that required all four-year-olds to be eligible for free pre-K. We implemented the program as a voucher, so parents get to choose public or private pre-K. The vast majority, 85%, choose a private pre-K option. We assess our kids when they enter kindergarten on developmental readiness and early literacy readiness. Then we tie those scores back to the pre-K provider that they used, so parents are making an informed decision about which pre-K program are the most effective. And so here are some slides on results. This chart is on the state test in elementary, the percent of kids making progress in reading. And you can see tremendous progress made from 54% to 71% of our elementary students reading on grade level. Middle school, 48% to 64%, huge increases in the percent of kids reading on grade level in middle school. But I want to point out, this is that policy where you can see the third grade reading policy actually hit the data. For 3 years in a row, from 2003 to 2005, we had absolutely flat performance in middle school. And then all of a sudden in 2006, we saw this increase in the sixth grade in the percent of kids reading on grade level. We reached out and talked to the educators. What's going on here? Why was this occurring? And what they said was, for the first time, we are noticing that we are receiving students out of elementary school that are more prepared to receive middle school instruction. And you can actually trace it back to that policy in 2003. So the first class of better prepared fourth graders was in 2004. In fifth grade, 2005. And they hit middle school in 2006. So for the representative that asked that question on seeing the impact of that policy, you can see that class of students, because they got some of the things that we're going to talk about more in Dr. Green's presentation, you can see that bubble of increased performance continue past fourth grade. It wasn't a one-year blip in fourth grade and then a decline. You see that trend line continuing into the middle school years. In high school, I'm not going to brag about this performance. The only thing good on this slide is that we're going in the right direction and that we hope with more policies that we've put in place since then that we're going to continue to see increases in high school performance. This is switching back now to the NAEP, from our state test to the NAEP. The Goldwater Institute did some research and found that if you treated Florida Hispanic students as if they were their own state, they would tie or outperform the average student in 31 states, including Minnesota. So our Hispanic students that are primarily low income treated as a state, would outperform the average or would tie the average student in Minnesota in performance now. Our African-American students, again, treating them as a separate state, they would tie or outscore the average student in eight states, and they're poised, we believe, in the next round of NAEP scores to beat another half dozen states. And then the last few slides, Madam Chair, are just some more information about student progress, and I'd be happy to either take more questions or switch to Dr. Green's presentation, whatever you'd prefer.
Representative Peterson, Sandra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I had two questions, and one dealt with the preschool, and it says that you have a quality rating system. And who does the rating, or is that just, it sounds like there is a group that does the quality rating, or is it because you take the kindergartners and then you go back and look at those programs to see which of the programs were effective. How did you do the quality rating system for your four-year-olds?
Ms. Levesque.
Madam Chair, it's done by the state. So the state takes, within the first 30 days that a child enters kindergarten, they're screened for developmental readiness and early literacy readiness. And then those scores get tracked back to the pre-K provider to come up with a readiness rate for that provider. So the state does it.
Okay, thank you. And
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question dealt with the third grade issue of a high, basically a high stakes test for third graders. And I'm wondering, you know, there's been so much discussion over the years about the psychological damage that can do, et cetera, and also I'm wondering about parents' reaction to keeping a child, you know, until they can pass that test, keeping them at within that third grade unit. I guess two questions. What's the parents' reaction? Do you have any ungraded kinds of schools where the students can progress at their rate? Because not every child is really ready, you know, to complete those years in the silos that we have put together for them. And then I'm wondering if they would also then, if they didn't pass, would they just enroll in another school district and say, well, I'm not going, or go to a private school or whatever if they didn't pass those tests? So I guess it's three different questions. Sorry about that.
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to remember them. First, on parents' reaction initially, we had a lot of concerned parents because they were concerned that one test could hold their child back. After a lot of explanation to the parents that it's more than one test, because we know a child could have a bad test day, so when they received information on alternative tests and on the student portfolio, I think that eased a lot of parents' concerns with the policy, although we needed to do a much better job of communicating that, and we didn't do that well in year one. Anecdotally, I'll tell you that my boss still gets emails to this day. I just literally, I should have brought the email 3 weeks ago, a parent emailed Governor Bush to say, my child was one of those kids who were retained because of your third grade policy. She's now an honor student in 11th grade, and I'm so thankful that she received that extra year and extra intervention. So parents do recognize it after time went on that the confidence level that their child received when they got to fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, and I have so much data, I didn't know how much data to bring. If you can see the data on the students that were retained and how they performed in the future years, how many more of them when they got to fourth grade were not just level two readers, they were level five readers. So they were the most advanced in their class, and the confidence level that I think being one of the best readers in the class gave them once they hit fourth grade and moved beyond, I think is something that's hard to quantify with numbers, but you can see it in the stories that we hear from parents. And then I'm so sorry that I forgot whatever.
A follow-up?
Representative Peterson.
Or Mr. Chair, which one I read. What do you think is the difference? Is it the maturation level, the additional 4 year, like a 4 year situation, or is it that they just need more academic? Because we have numbers of K kindergarten parents who do, quote, redshirt their children to keep them out another year because they realize they're not ready because of maturation, emotional, social, or even academic abilities. And so they keep them out a different year in order to mature. And not all parents are aware of that, of how to do that. So is it a maturation thing, or is it really the academic learning that they would that they need in those 3 years? What do you think? Or do you have data on that?
Mr. Chairman, I remember the other question was, does it count in every school? And the answer is yes. So students can't just switch to another county for the third grade test not to count. It applies everywhere. And then your more recent question, and I think maybe Commissioner Wynn, Dr. Wynn could shed some light on this. We don't just have a retention policy for the sake of retention. There were so many things that went into the policy, especially what the Department of Education. Federal funds to create a progress monitoring and reporting network so teachers could identify and do interventions all through the year. One of the things that our teachers appreciated the most was actually having immediate feedback on where their child was deficient so they knew where to focus their attention. Was it a fluency issue for this child? Was it a comprehension issue? Was it a phonemic awareness issue where the child didn't know what the sounds were? I think all those things wrapped around, and again, Commissioner Wynn could talk more about what exactly our department did on a professional development side of the equation to make sure that when the child was retained, it was something different, meeting the needs of that child, not just retaining for the sake of retaining, we wouldn't advocate doing.
Thank you.
At this time, Representative Myra Mariani and Breinhardt, is it okay if we, I just want to make sure it's okay with these members. I'd like to hear from our two additional testifiers here, and then I promise you'll be at the top of the list. Is that okay? Is that all right? Thank you. So please proceed with your testimony.
Oh, okay. Sure.
I'm going to – I'm just here because my good luck's made me, but – I know the hour is getting late, but – you know, to put it kind of plainly, like with the AP program, everything we did, even though a lot of it was so new, that we recognized that, and I think we're successful in working with our partners in the legislature to understand that if you don't put together a comprehensive, you don't have a command focus on reading and. We had a couple of years to prepare for it, where we did a lot of work to have a command focus on reading. That's what produced the results, I think. The accountability piece with regard to the social promotion basically said we can't fail students and have it not noticed anymore. We can't fail students and move them out of third grade to fourth grade because we can, or we're just, you know. So that was the option that we tried to close off. It's not going to be let go. But we didn't say, okay, it's up to you. We took the responsibility on helping them meet that. Meet that requirement and have better instruction and better outcomes for kids.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record so 100 years from now they know who you are.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jay Green. I'm a professor of education reform at the University of Arkansas. And I think Representative Davney, in addition to his neologism, which is actually a word, also raised a very good point, which is Florida was doing a lot of things. And Patricia Levesque has shown us how results have been improving in Florida on NAEP and on the state test, but there are 20, 30 different interventions going on here at once, and it's sometimes hard to know which thing really was doing the heavy lifting and which things other states should focus on and be imitating in the hopes of achieving similar success. And I've studied three of Florida's larger reform efforts, and mostly want to talk about social promotion, but also about the effects of two different choice programs in the state, the Opportunity Scholarship Program and the McKay Scholarship Program, which is the voucher program for students with disabilities. So on social promotion, Representative Peterson is also right to wonder what is it that is producing these gains. And I should be clear that the intervention here really is just two things. It's not as if whatever reading instruction is done couldn't have been done before or couldn't have been done without calling the student a third grader again. You could do it and call the student a fourth grader. The question is, why do you have to retain students? And the theory is that you have to retain students to sharpen the minds of the adults. It's to get the adults to be motivated to do these things which they could have done before and which they could do even if they called the student a fourth grader, but they wouldn't be as likely to do. And the second thing that a program like this does is that it provides cover for educators to do things that they know need to be done but don't have the authority or the protection to do easily on their own. So it's always been the case that educators could retain students, but they received a lot of negative feedback if they tried to do so. Parents would be unhappy. Administrators would be unhappy. It was a sign of failure, and people didn't like it. And what a test-based retention policy does is it provides cover for the teacher. The teacher can say, it's not me, it's the test. And in doing so, the reality is that actually the teacher can promote virtually any child that the teacher wants because one of the good cause exemptions is a portfolio which the teacher can assemble. But what the test-based retention policy does is it allows teachers to retain students that they kind of know should be retained but couldn't before. And it motivates the adults to do things that they otherwise were not motivated to do. So let me just briefly go through the research on this. This is research that Marcus Winters and I did and published in the journal Education, Finance, and Policy in 2008. The policy, again, as Patricia Levesque described, was that students who didn't meet a certain threshold of performance on the third grade test, the default assumption was that student would repeat the third grade. However, there were exemptions. And in fact, 41% of those students who failed to meet the threshold of reading performance in third grade were nevertheless promoted to fourth grade because of one of those six good cause exemptions. And we looked at the effect of being retained under this program in two different ways. One way we did it was by comparing students across years. So the students who were in third grade in 2001-2, the year just before the policy was implemented, who scored below the test threshold were just like the students the next year who scored below the test threshold, except that they were 1 year apart in age. Okay, so when their birthday occurred was what distinguished between whether they were subject to this policy or whether they were not. And so we could compare the future performance of students who were similarly low performing, similar in their demographics. We could compare their future performance based on whether they were retained under the policy or not because they were born a year earlier or a year later. And so the results were that after 1 year, the students who were retained were outperforming the students who were low performing just like them but who were in the third grade the year before them, outperformed them by 20 scale points after 1 year and 152 scale points after 2 years. Now, I know that scale points are not meaningful from one state to another because every state uses a different test, which is why researchers standardize all gains into what are called standard deviation effect sizes. But since state representatives have no idea what a standard deviation effect size is, for the most part. I've translated it further into a month of instruction, what the equivalent in months of instruction would be. So after 1 year, the retained students were outperforming the promoted students who were in the cohort just in front of them by about a half a month of instruction. Not a very big effect after 1 year. But after 2 years, 2 years out from the retention decision, the retained students were outperforming their promoted counterparts by 5.6 months of instruction, which was quite large. Now, what's interesting there is that it grew bigger. The effect was kind of small and then got bigger. And the suggestion here is that the ability to read is a benefit that compounds over time. Or to put it the other way, if you cannot read effectively, it's very hard to catch up and make progress. That problem gets worse as you move along. So the program was helping people learn how to walk so that they could later run. And if you still haven't learned how to walk, running gets all the harder later on. But we looked at this in another way, too, which is actually much more rigorous than comparing students from 1 year to the next year, because after all, perhaps there's some difference across years in who's in that grade. And so the next design is what's called a regression discontinuity design, so I'll translate that as well. What it does is it takes advantage of the fact that there's this bright line threshold that students have to hit in order to be automatically promoted. If students hit that score or above, they automatically go to the next grade. If they don't, the default assumption is they're retained. Well, the students who are very close to that bright line are virtually identical. So you could be 1 point below the threshold and your default retained, and you could be 1 point above the threshold and your default promoted. But on average, you're identical. It's just a matter of luck whether you're 1 point above the line or 1 point below the line. And so we could compare the students barely above the threshold to those barely below to judge their future academic performance to see if students benefited by being retained. And in fact, they did, and the results are very similar to when we do the across the year comparison. Little less than a month of instruction benefit after 1 year, but 6.5 months of instruction benefit after 2 years. And this is actually a pretty remarkable effect if you think about it. The students who are one grade behind, who've been exposed to one less grade of curriculum, have more skills, are able to demonstrate more reading skills than their counterparts who are in the next grade, who were just like them but scored a few points above them on the test. I mean, barely above them on the test at the point of retention. And so despite being exposed to one less grade worth of curriculum, they still know more and can do more things, which is very impressive. I should say that this finding is different from the conventional wisdom among educators. The conventional wisdom among educators is that we know that retention is a bad thing. It hurts kids. This is well known. It's been documented by decades of research. The difficulty is that the decades of research is based on a different kind of retention and is based on a different kind of research. So the different kind of retention was teacher subjective retention rather than test-based retention. Teacher subjective retention was teachers very rarely identified students for retention. And that's a fundamentally different kind of intervention than when you have a test-based retention that actually hits a fairly large chunk of kids. It produces different kinds of research. When you have teacher-based subjective retention, then teachers identify kids with really serious problems for retention. And researchers, when they try to compare those kids to other kids, really can't make an apple-to-apple comparison because no other kid is exactly like those kids that they retain. And even when researchers try to control for things they can observe, the teacher has observed a lot of things about those kids they retained that caused them to want to retain that kid. And so when you see bad outcomes for those retained kids later on, that has a lot more to do with the problems that caused the teacher to retain them than with the retention itself. I should also note that even well-designed research of programs in other locations has produced different results. And so research based on test-based promotion, done well with rigorous research designs in Chicago, and programs also in Georgia and New York City, did not produce the same results that were found in Florida. And what I think this tells us is that we have to be very careful about how we design and implement these test-based promotion policies, because if you don't design your exemptions properly, you'll get undesired results. And if you don't design the interventions of what you're going to do when the student is retained, if you don't design that properly, you won't get the same results. In Georgia, for example, there was a problem where they essentially exempted almost all the kids who were subject to the test-based retention. So the program failed because they just exempted everyone, even without legitimate authorization. In Chicago, technically there were no exemptions allowed, and nevertheless the city exempted a variety of students, which led to other sorts of problems there too. So I think it's important not just to look at having a test-based promotion policy, but think about properly designing the exemptions and properly designing the reading interventions that you're going to do with the students when they're retained. And I think Florida did very well on both of those points, and which is why they had much better results with the test-based retention policy than did other locations. Let me, I know we're running very late on time, very briefly talk to you about choice programs in Florida. And I shouldn't have to tell you much about choice here in Minnesota since you have so much of it. But perhaps you'll find it reassuring, or perhaps it will make you interested in other kinds of choice programs. That there's been a lot of research in Florida, including research I've done, on what happens to students who remain in traditional public schools when choice is expanded and traditional public schools face increased competition. And the Opportunity Scholarship Program, this was the program where if schools failed twice in a four-year period, their students were offered vouchers. Four different evaluations have looked at what happened to students who remained in the traditional public schools, and all four found that the public schools faced with the threat of increased choice and competition dramatically improved their performance. That is, public schools have the capacity, when facing challenges, to rise to those challenges and improve their performance. And so rather than fearing that increased choice and competition will drain them of talented students and the resources to improve, it actually appears to motivate them to improve. And despite the fact that, as Patricia Levesque mentioned, only about 800 students participated in that program, the program had beneficial effects on many more students because it benefited all the students who didn't participate, who remained in traditional schools, because they were motivated to improve. The other program that I can very briefly tell you about is the McKay Scholarship Program, which is the voucher program for students with disabilities. Marcus Winders and I have an article forthcoming in Education Evaluation Policy Analysis, which looks at what happens to disabled students who remain in public schools as those schools face increased choice and competition from vouchers. And interestingly, we find that the more private schools there are within a 5 or 10 mile radius of each traditional public school, the more competition that those schools face, the better the performance of disabled students who remain in the traditional public schools. Again, public schools appear to be able to rise to the challenge and improve their performance rather than being hindered by the increased competition. So those are three programs that I've looked at that with rigorous research designs, we can know with pretty high confidence that there have been improvements as a result of them. But there have been 20 other interesting programs that Florida has tried, and I think additional research on those might suggest what contributions they've made to that overall improvement in NAEP that we've seen in Florida relative to the country. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And Commissioner, did you wish to testify as well, or are you just here to be the good-looking guy like you said you are?
Just as a final word, there are a couple of things that I think are important to remember in that what we've learned in Florida. And number one is you have got to have a partnership in your agency that's responsible for education. passing a policy, it's absolutely remarkable, but it's at least true in Florida, maybe not here, but it's as, almost as if it didn't happen, if nobody in the agency is making it happen, is out there talking about it and putting in processes, providing assistance or what have you. I think that's number one. And number two, we get a lot of questions about, well, couldn't you have just done this? And couldn't you have just done that? You know, one part and another part. And there's a dilemma that education reformers face, and that is you don't experiment on children who have a limited time in your education system. You do the best you can for them. So what we tried to craft is, even though we didn't know for sure when we were starting a new policy, we just tried to be as thoughtful as possible at putting together all the pieces that we could imagine would contribute positively to the success of children, which was always the focus. And we put together those and did the best we could on the quality side of making that happen. We paid a lot of attention to data, collected data to find out what was going on. For example, you know, if we had discovered after the first year of the third grade retention that we'd had 50% of the kids who were promoted on a portfolio, then we would have probably had reason to think that maybe they were just being passed on a portfolio. So you have to pay attention to the data, and you have to put in processes that anticipate things that can go wrong. And one of the things that we did on the portfolio is we structured it as well as we could at the state level so that it faithfully followed the process for a portfolio, then it would truly justify promoting the kid who may have been 3 points below the cutoff score but for a bad day or whatever. And so you try to think through those things and take them into account and put in as many things as possible. And finally, keep at it. Their change in education creates controversy. There are always going to be unhappy people, as you all know, with almost anything you do. And if you're getting good, if you feel like it's the right thing to do, it's supported by data, you know you're attacking an important problem, and you're getting positive data on it, and try to stick with it. That's, I think, the lessons that we learned in Florida. And you move from the parents are upset about their child being retained to having more and more say, you know, it turned my child around in terms of how they felt in school, because 180 days a year of failure is much more debilitating year in and year out than spending another year under the promise of doing something more focused on that individual child's success. And if that can be done properly, communicated to parents properly, then I think you can successfully deal with, you know, a lot of the concerns that people have with a very strong accountability process.
Well, thank you very much. And we do still have members who wish to ask questions. Are you still available to all three of you to answer questions? Great. Representative Myra.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Levesque, I have a question on slide 28. It's page 14. And you have the rewards for successful schools. I was wondering, in Florida, who determines how rewards are used?
Is that the school recognition? Mr.
Yes.
Chairman, is that the school recognition?
Mm-hmm.
That was purely based on the school grade. So if a school increased from an F to a D?
I understand that part, okay. But once the funds are available to the school, who determines how they will be used at that school?
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, we let the school staff, so the principal and the teachers, and then we have a group called the School Advisory Council that's made up of parents and faculty at the school. So all of those folks work jointly to come up with how to spend the funds. The first year or two, it's controversial because people have different opinions on how to use the funds. Once the school got in its rhythm on spending the funds, whereas, you know, some of the schools would say blanket, we're going to do the same bonuses for everybody in the school. Others would say we're going to give instructional staff a higher bonus than the staff at the that are support staff. Other schools would just say we're going to carve 75% for bonuses, 25% are going to go to new programs that the principal wants to implement. Once they got their formula down for how they wanted to use the funds, it was pretty simple after that, should they earn them again, to just follow the formula that they had already decided locally.
Thank you.
Representative Myra.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One, I suspect, requires an answer longer than we have here, but very quickly, my first question is, what do you use to determine a year's worth of knowledge in your progress category?
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, if you could go, I usually have a slide on this, but I tried to keep this 67-page PowerPoint shorter than normal, but if you go to slide 18, where there's the scale at the bottom that shows.
Page 18 or slide 18?
Well, it's page 18 on my printout. That one right there. So at the scale at the bottom, you can see page that nine. If a student scores on level 3, their grade level, 4 and 5 is above grade level, 1 and 2 is below grade level. We give credit to a school in three ways for a student making a gain. One is if a student moves up a performance level. So they were scoring at level 2 in 4th grade, and they moved to level 3 in 5th grade. So if they move up a performance level, we count that as a gain for the school. If a student stays grade level or higher but doesn't change performance levels, so they were a level 3, a grade level reader in 5th grade, and they remained level 3 in 6th grade, we count that as the student making progress, a year's worth of progress. And then the bottom two performing levels, levels 1 and level 2, are very wide bands of developmental scale score points. And so the State Board has adopted a rule that basically identifies the number of points in level 1 and level 2 that a student could move for the school to earn credit for a gain. So you could be a very low level, level 1 student, and move to a higher performing level 1 student and still get credit for making progress with that child. There's three ways.
So, Representative Mariani.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Leves, so I think I get it. But nonetheless, the measurement tool for this is still the FCAT. Is that correct?
Ms. Levesque.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, on page 20, you have the stop funding failure slide, where we talk about the supplemental academic instruction categorical. And I have a ton of questions, but, you know, again, we don't have a ton of time. But let me quickly just throw out very quick things here. One, what I'm curious about, is, and I do notice that, you know, there's summer school dropout prevention flexibility. We used to have here in the state, I don't think we've got it back, Representative Greiling, but we used to have extended day category, which I think probably mirrors something like the summer school piece here. So clearly the state has had, you know, some value at some point of those kind of activities in our schools. I'll stop editorializing. My question has to do with how does this categorical relate with the application of Title I funds in your state? Is this a categorical that's laid on top of the distribution of Title I funds? Does the state of Florida supplement Title I funding with a Florida equivalent to that? And then the same kind of question relative to ELL funding.
Levesque.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. This doesn't impact Title I funding, so Title I funding still flows according to federal policy. All we did, if you think about our funding formula, let's say had 25 different components. What we tried to do was identify the existing two or three or four or five components that went toward specific types of intervention programs, summer school, dropout prevention. There were weights in our formula for certain vocational programs to help the at-risk students get on a vocational track. There were all these pieces of our funding formula that went for specific things that only if the district did those things could they earn those funds. We just said we're going to take a different look at how we do funding in those categories. And so we basically collapsed all of those three or four or five or six existing pots, put them into one, and said, this is what we want you to do with this one bigger pot of money. Help the struggling schools, help the struggling students. And we don't care how you do it. We aren't going to prescribe to you how to do it. You don't have to run a dropout prevention program if you don't want to. If you can come up with a better way to help those high school students at risk of not graduating. So they were given flexibility on the means, but the outcome measure for us was helping the schools and the struggling students.
So, Mr. Chair, just so I understand it, I'll stop here. The implementation of this supplemental academic instruction categorical then, which I take it is new, relatively new, you know, tied to this model. That was something that was not just simply laid on top of the existing logic of the formula, K-12 formula for the state, but actually happened as a result of going back into the formula and making major adjustments based on different assumptions. Is that correct? Yeah. I'm seeing nods of the head, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, it is. So we still have pieces of our funding formula that give extra money if you're dealing with a student with a disability or an English language learner, and there are still special pots of money for rural districts and special pots of money for cost of living adjustments. This is basically the collapsing of four or five of those specific things that we felt districts should get some flexibility over as long as they were meeting some of the outcomes that we were now demanding of them with an A through F grading scale and some other things.
Thank you,
Marietta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably have about 10 questions, and I'm going to try to limit myself to two lines of questioning because I'm sure the chair would give me a different direction if I pursue this for too long. But
that was one of the questions.
That was a statement. Thank you. The first has to do with an issue that the chair raised indirectly through a comment on the retention policy and its effect on the NAEP data. And I'm sure you're well aware that a great deal of the external literature that's available on your program goes after your NAEP data, fourth grade data, particularly on the basis of the effect of the retention policy on that data. And I'm not asking you to address all that because you already promised some data related to your test scores themselves that might address that consideration. But my concern actually has to do with your presentation itself, because the first several pages of slides here only are based on fourth grade reading NAEP data and comparing Minnesota and Florida. And as some a Minnesotan, if I wanted to understand the fairness of that comparison better, I would want to see all the data, all the NAEP data, fourth grade, eighth grade, science, math, across the board, to understand whether the implication that is implicit in these pages is valid. And that wouldn't necessarily tell me its validity, but it would at least give me more of a measure of its consistency. So that's a concern I have with how you presented your data. And, you know, you can respond or not as to whether you think the other bodies of data would support that. But first line of questioning.
Sure. Ms. Levesque, do you want to respond?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we did focus on fourth grade NAEP. I gave some summary data on prior to our policies in fourth and eighth grade reading and math, we were near the bottom nationally. And in fourth and eighth grade reading and in fourth grade math, we've now moved above the national average. In eighth grade math, we're still about 3 points below the national average. So we could do charts on all of those other for math and for eighth grade data, and you would still see the trend line going up in all of those categories because, again,
We were near the bottom in all of those categories before and have seen upward trajectory. I will tell you, even if you look at our state FCAT data slide, we made the most progress in elementary since the reforms have been put in place. We have made what I would consider modest gains in middle school, and in high school, we're still struggling. And so we don't have the solution for everything in our public education system, but where we were compared to where we are now has been, not by my standard, by many independent researchers from Stanford, from Harvard, from the Manhattan Institute, from Goldwater Institute. I mean, there are several. I think the American Legislative Exchange Council just issued a 50-state book on NAEP and what has occurred in all 50 states from just 2003 to 2010. And in all of those indicators, Florida progress has been the lead in the country.
Representative Brenner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that response, and I'm in no way wanting to impugn the success of Florida in terms of that measure. It's more what we learned comparatively from what, even though it takes up 10 pages, is only one body of data, one fourth-grade reading NAEP tests broken down, and as opposed to looking at the whole NAEP landscape. And I think those who have been involved in NAEP testing in Minnesota, and Representative Norton would be one of those, might like an opportunity to speak to Minnesota's successes in NAEP, which this data doesn't necessarily do. But that's the end of that line of questioning. My other line of questioning is a little broader and involves just a brief foray into the history of rankings in Minnesota, because I have some concern with the possibility that we as a state might move to take your grading system and impose it on our current situation, because we indeed have done a ranking system previously. We had a 5-star ranking system. Now, that might more parallel your 1-5 and be less accessible to parents in your terms and so forth. But my concern about a grading system isn't only whether it's accessible to parents, but whether it's accurate, valid, and reliable. Because to say that a parent knows what an F is, yes, but if that school might contest whether it truly is an F school, that's the sort of situation we ended up in with our 5-star ranking system. We had within the same communities schools that were ranked 2 stars and 5 stars, and in the multiple measure approach, those schools were within a hair's breadth of one another in their ACT results, all graduation rates, all those things. But on the single measure of AYP, they had a small subset that weren't making that measure. So when we looked at that, we as a state abandoned that star ranking system. We didn't abandon the measures, but we started to look at what measures from a multiple measure perspective would more accurately give you a basis for ranking schools. And underlying that, you know, when we teach, and I'm sure you do this too, when you teach your staffs about how to look at data, you talk about triangulation. I mean, we teach them one piece of data, it's a one-dimensional perspective, one body of data. So get them to walk around the object, see it from 3 dimensions, have at least 3 pieces of data, triangulate. So that's the move we've made as a state to look at. We have a growth model in place. We actually have, in statute, rigorous course completion measure. But we have spent 2 years being sure that it's statistically valid and reliable as we pull together those measures of completion. We have student engagement measures. So we have 3 points of view to look at school success. But before we put the letters on, or the stars, or the numbers, or whatever it is, we've made a commitment in statute to come at each point back to the data. And this is because we have worked with a wide range of expert measurement people we have in our state, from the University of Minnesota and from a group called MAG, Minnesota Assessment Group, that have all said, we want to know whether the data really tells us what we think it's going to tell us before we attach high-stakes consequences to it. So we're taking what I consider a much more measured approach to this that avoids putting high-stakes consequences in place before we know whether the data indeed is valid and reliable? And I'd like you to respond to that, and as well as the triangulation issue.
Sure. Representative Breyer, do we student engagement that you mentioned?
Yes.
Has that actually been implemented yet?
It's in statute with a timeline. And that's because we put a review process in place. Stakeholder groups have been meeting, coming together to look at the measure, look at it, how it would be implemented, its accuracy, reliability, and the whole goal is to have all three measures in place by 2014.
I just wanted to make sure that I didn't misunderstand it, because I thought maybe...
No. It is in, excuse me, Mr. Chair, it is in statute, but it is not implemented at the district level.
Ms. Levesque.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative, for the question. We really, and Commissioner Wynn could talk more about this because I worked on in the legislature when the formative policies on school grading took place. But I would say this. What we wanted to make sure was the things that mattered the most that we could measure objectively were the things that comprised our school grading system. So for us, it was three things. Achievement or performance of students, individual progress, and the progress of the lowest performing 25%. All of it was focused on our test, and there was a balance, 50% on achievement, because you wanted to make sure that your ultimate outcomes for the school were based on kids reading or doing math or science or writing on grade level or higher, half on progress. And half on progress because you wanted to make sure you were incentivizing not just the schools that were receiving kids three grade levels behind, that they were getting credit for moving the kids forward, but it also pushed the higher performing schools further. Sometimes I tell this when I give the presentation. We didn't have the progress measure the first 2 years we did our school grading system because we only tested in grades 4, 8, and 10. And so when our initial law passed, we had to expand the tests in grades 3, 5, 7, 9, et cetera. So the year that we put the gains portion or the progress measures into place, we actually saw D and F schools move up to C and D because they were getting credit for making progress with kids who were so far behind. But we had A and B schools that dropped to B and C because they had high performers that they were not continuing to push far in the process. So keeping a balance between performance and progress is very important. I will tell you that New York City implemented an A through F grading scale. Their formula was different than our formula. So they weighted progress twice as much as performance in their scale. And they had some credibility issues the year they rolled out their grades because some schools were getting A's that no one really wanted to send their children to just because they made a lot of progress. Mm-hmm. And then they had schools like Stuyvesant that was not getting an A, that was getting a C, and nobody believed in their initial round of A through F grading because they double-weighted progress over performance. We do think that keeping a balance will help you with any misperceptions that occur out there. The other comment that I would make when you kind of brought up how I think Minnesota tried to align 5 stars with no child left behind and adequate yearly progress. I'll just quote from my boss, Governor Bush, when he said, the main thing that's good about the federal no child left behind policy was that it made our A-plus plan look so much better. And so it was truly, if you wanted, we didn't try to reconcile the two. We focused on the state policy because we could control the state policy. Reauthorization is going to come up, and what's adequate yearly progress is going to change. I will tell you, the way we tried to reconcile the two was not in actually what the grade of the school was, because a lot of Florida schools would not be making adequate yearly progress based on the federal scale, but we know that the kids are learning and there's a lot of progress with being made. We tried to reconcile it as a student report card. So you can get a B in math by your teacher, but in the comments column, it may say, however, Johnny's really still struggling in compound fractions. So that's how we reconciled the state and federal plan. The school is a B, but maybe they still need to do a lot of work with their English language learner population in math and their students with disability population in reading. So that we didn't actually mold our state policy to federal law because we can't control how that's going to change. And we focused all of our rewards, consequences, things on the state policy, not the federal. And that's, I think, how we better tried to reconcile the two instead of trying to merge them together.
Representative Brenner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate that because that is what we've tried to do in our current growth model, is to better reflect our definitions of proficiency and progress at a state level. So our growth model does embody both of those elements. We still have the connection to AYP, and that's because in the past administration, that was the perception of our Department of Education. That may be open to further discussion as we move forward. But I really appreciate you sharing what you're doing. I think it's going to take a lot of analysis for us to begin to absorb how it translates to what we're currently doing.
And before we go to our final question from Representative Depke, I do want to thank our testifiers for coming forward today. You should know that there was strong bipartisan agreement that we were going to take the committee to see you down in Florida.
Yes.
It didn't pan out, so you had to come up and see us. But I do, Commissioner, did you have something to add before we go to Representative Depke for the final question?
What we were unable to do today, and in case we gave the wrong impression, this reform movement didn't spring out of the blue. We had spent about 11 years doing things that didn't work. Okay. Our first education accountability legislation said each school picks their own goals. If you don't make the goal, report yourself to the state of Florida. We had 14 schools all in one district reported themselves to the state of Florida. Somebody didn't get the memo there that that's not what you're supposed to do. So we went incrementally and tried different things. One of the things that we tried is we had, even in our first reform legislation, had multiple measures in school grading. Mm-hmm. And we spent, because I was the guy that went out there to work with school principals and superintendents, parent groups, to decide how to measure, how to best put attendance, discipline, parent involvement, those are the three big ones, into our school grading. And when it was all said and done, with a faithful effort after a full year of going around the state and meeting, the Superintendents Association, the Principals Association, teachers all said take those out because they can't be objectively, accurately measured. They can be manipulated. So we took them out, and our school grading formula then focused on student achievement, which was the command focus. And then less than a year later, we got criticized for only focusing on student achievement in our school grading. So there's no exact science, and even I guess one of the most rigorous tests that I could think of would be an airline pilot passing a pilot's test, okay? But you know what? That bar of how much precision and competence it takes is a man-made decision. So you have to decide the best you can on aligning your level of expectation with the standards that you believe as a state need to be met by your students, and you need to set it and get as much consensus that it accurately reflects what you want for the children of Minnesota, and set it and go with it. It's not right or wrong. It is a value, more of a value judgment than anything else.
Representative Depke, you get the last question.
Well, thank you. I have just one area, and that's in the school choice, and you mentioned it briefly, and that's charter schools. In Minnesota, we have seen a tremendous increase in charter school attendance. Actually about 200% increase in the last 5 years, primarily 30% of our students now in charter schools are English as a second language, and free and reduced lunch and so forth. Do you include charter schools in your grading system? Are they part of the grading, and do you use the same standards for those?
To any of the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do. Charter schools are treated just like traditional public schools. Same tests, same school grading system, same accountability measures all apply to the charter schools.
Okay.
And, Deputy?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question on we have a category here that also we are strong in, not as strong. It's not obviously anywhere near the other choices, but we do have a strong group of homeschooling. And we have been doing that for many years, and very parents are very passionate about that. Where do they fit in this rating system, or do they not? Do you suggest they do not fit in that?
Ms. Levesque?
Mr. Chairman, homeschool students and private school students in Florida do not have to take the state exams unless there's a private school student that's on a voucher. So depending on the voucher program, they can take a norm reference test that can be compared to our state test. The things that we do for home education students, our accountability system is basically the school district can request a portfolio of the child's work. And within 30 days during the year, the parent has to provide that to the superintendent. At the end of the year, our home education students have to demonstrate that their child made progress in one of five ways. They can either take the state test, a certified teacher can look at the portfolio, a certified state psychologist. There's several ways that a home education parent can show that the child made progress. And if they don't, they have 1 year to remediate. If not, the child loses the ability to be in home education. We've also provided several other policies in place to encourage home education and to help them. So our Florida Virtual School, where it's mainly high school courses that are offered on Florida Virtual, home education parents can choose those programs on a per course basis. So you'll see a lot of them that will go to the Florida Virtual School for high school science, high school math, and then the parent continues to teach the other subjects. We let homeschool students do dual enrollment. We let home education students come back into the school system for one or two courses. So the child could enroll for just biology with school district and then remain being home educated in all the other areas. And then to help with the socialization aspect, we let our home education students participate in interscholastic activities at any public or private school in their district. So they can participate in swim competition and debate and basketball and football and all those types of things. Some of you may have heard of Tim Tebow. You know, the Heisman Trophy winner is a home education student that used our law to participate in sports at a public high school.
Thank you very much.
And thank you again to our three testifiers. We greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to fly up to Minnesota during what is not a very welcoming time, at least in terms of the weather. We greatly appreciate you highlighting for us what you've done in Florida and helping legislators learn lessons from some of your successes and, candidly, some of the things that you guys have tried, so you don't want to go that way. So we really appreciate that. For members of the audience, members of committee, if you're interested in lobbying the chair, I'm going to be at Mancini's tonight, so you can come by and see me there if you'd like. But and to the testifiers, if you're not flying out tonight, maybe if you guys haven't had dinner, we can you guys can welcome to join us there as well. But we greatly appreciate you coming out tonight, and thank you very much. We really appreciate it. All right. If there's nothing else for members of the committee, this is adjourned. Thank you.